Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Media, and welcome back to another of our Personal Democracy Plus conference calls that we do regularly with movers, shakers, thinkers, and doers, innovators in the place where technology collides with politics and government and civic life. And I'm really thrilled today to have as our guest Martin Avila, who is the founder and CEO of Terra Eclipse, which is a nationwide leader in conservative political technology and consulting. And we're going to be talking with him about how grassroots conservatives are tapping the power of open networks. And just a little background about Martin is sort of a classic tech geek story. He started Terra Eclipse back in 1999 while he was still in high school, and he has since built the company into a leader in the field focused on serving conservative candidates. His company has worked for clients including FreedomWorks, the Tim Pawlenty presidential campaign in this cycle, the Ron Paul 2008 campaign, and a number of other groups and senators, congressmen. And one of the things that Martin and his team have done, which is certainly going to be a major topic of conversation, is they've launched a open network site called Freedom Connector, which is being run by FreedomWorks, but is a place where anybody can join and create a profile, connect, you know, all the sorts of things that we see in many other political social network platforms, such as MyBarackObama.com. And it's very interesting to see the same sorts of techniques being used across the spectrum. So, Martin, I thought what would be great to start maybe is, you know, if you would tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of how you got into this space and, you know, what you think, you know, how you think about how technology and the fact that everybody's networked, you know, can be used to empower more people and you know, move the political process.
Yeah, start there. Thanks. Thank you so much. You know, starting a business in California is probably one of the hardest things to do that I've ever encountered. You know, through that process, you know, we didn't start off as a political company at all. We were just doing web development. And but just running into that constant government bottleneck, the taxes and the fees and all those things that come with being a business in California really kind of forced us to kind of look at political issues. And through that, we ended up, you know, getting political clients and those sorts of things. So that's how kind of we ended up in politics. It wasn't really something that I set out to do or that we set out to do, but it just kind of was a natural movement into this space. And then
to get into politics. You know,
getting into politics. From there we kind of took this Silicon Valley innovation and started applying it, because we weren't political science majors or anything like that. You know, we just kind of started implementing some technology for some campaigns, and the next thing you know, we're doing these money bombs for Ron Paul. And, you know, so we just kind of look at things a little differently, I think, because we're not really into the traditional, you know, what I view as really a command and control structure of politics, where you've got these guys who are power brokering a lot of influence. I really kind of always have viewed it as kind of that Ron Paul grassroots momentum, that broad base of support that then influences issues. Mm-hmm. And so that's really kind of our philosophy here, is how do you harness that decentralized, broad-based level of support that really can't be brokered. And, you know, you see in the cycle that there's a lot of, you know, the pundits are just completely stumped as to what's going on with it. You know, they say this is, you know, Romney's got it locked up, and then this is going to happen, and then everything just changes. I think that is a real consequence of what is happening online with the conservative movement. You know, up until this cycle, conservative grassroots activists haven't been online as much. I mean, it's been a gradual, you know, the left, that happened a long time ago.
Right.
And you saw that with the Dean campaign. Right. You know, that same kind of thing was happening back then. But, you know, Ron Paul was the start. Then you had the Tea Party movement. And now it's going to the evangelicals. They're on Facebook. They're on Twitter. They're discussing things on Freedom Connector. And mm-hmm. now you're going to see that same evolution, I think, in the Republican conservative movement, where this broad-based, issue-focused, principled factions within the party have a much stronger voice. And as we're continuing to deploy tools online to leverage that, I think you're going to get – the establishment is really going to start become – I mean, they're already afraid. You can already see it's palpable, the fear of the grassroots and the way they talk about it, the way the pundits talk about it. It's just – it's really interesting to see that this – it's really starting to come together. So
that's very, very interesting. Let's hold that thought. I actually don't want to let you kind of slide past – you know, I mean, your history in getting into this is important too, because the fact is – you know, you're based in California.
Sure.
I may be wrong about this, but just about every other, you know, major political technology company that works on, you know, national level stuff is on the East Coast. And, you know, so you're about as far away from, you know, I mean, actually, there are a few people, Carrie Chisholm in Seattle. I mean, it's not like everybody is here on the East Coast. And obviously now Todd Herman and those other folks have started a new thing out in Seattle as well. So it's not like it's, only a measure of geography. But when you got into doing campaigns, I mean, you started out with local races, right? I mean, and you were just doing it because...
Yeah, it was issue-oriented stuff. You know, we were really tackling a lot of private property things and grassroots advocacy campaigns first. Like, that was really
you were working for local clients.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of developed your own method of, we're going to use the tools to enable lots of people to do things, as opposed to, you know, I mean, I think a lot of the reason why we still see this, as you put it, the command and control approach, is the very first experience that a lot of political consultants had with the internet was in 2000 when John McCain raised $1 million, you know, seemingly overnight after winning the New Hampshire primary.
Right.
And suddenly everybody said, oh, my God, it's a cash machine.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
and so people have been doing, you know, let's use it to raise money. And then the Dean campaign was very obviously seminal for a faction on the Democratic side, you know, led by people like Joe Trippi, who continued to argue that actually the tools can enable, you know, mass participation. But, you know, it's not like every Democratic campaign is designed according to those principles. But you came into this from, you know, working lower level races. I mean, can you tell us how you came to work for Ron Paul in 2008? Was that, you know, they came to you or you went to them?
It was funny. Through these private property and issue based campaigns, I just ended up meeting some of the people on that campaign over the course of a couple of years, and I saw Ron announced, and what I did, I just picked up the phone and called them. And I said, hey, you got, their website was terrible. It was absolute. There's a screenshot floating somewhere on our servers of the website as it was, and it was just about as outdated as you could have been. You know, no CMS, just a flat page. And what we did say, hey, look, we'll do your site for you. We'll get you a content management system, and you know, you guys will be able to at least put updates on your site because it was just completely outdated.
Right.
And they were like, okay, yeah, great, you know. And then, you know, through that, we kind of started to look at, you know, wow, this guy's got a lot of people. And let me step back a little bit. Like, Ron Paul built his empire, if you will, off of going to these what most people would consider obscure conferences and talking about what most people would at the time consider obscure issues.
Right.
But they're issues that people on the grassroots level research and know about or have contended with firsthand. I mean, you're talking about stuff like back in 2004, you know, like Agenda 21, Sustainable Development, which now Glenn Beck, of course, is now running with, and that's gotten a lot of national steam now, and it's actually still considered pretty obscure by a lot of Beltway folks. But out in the Mountain West, it's a very real issue, and you've got, you know, county supervisors up in Northern California who are tackling it firsthand, and it's a big issue now. But back then, Ron Paul would go to these conferences, and he would be open to at least hearing from people about those issues and say, hey, I'll get back to you on that. I'll have my staff look into it. Or you'd have somebody like Kent Snyder, who is his campaign chairman, actually going on these radio shows with these shortwave radio. Like, we're talking about low-tech stuff, but there's a network out there of people that just have, like, landlines. They don't have computers. They're on shortwave radio. But they're out there. And Ron and his people would reach out to them and talk to them about, you know, the IMF and inflation and the Federal Reserve, which back in 2004, super obscure. I mean, you would get, like, the weirdest looks from people when you would bring this stuff up. Now, you know, everybody's talking about the Fed. A lot of people are talking about Agenda 21. You know, IMF's a little more obscure, but that relates to, like, how the Greek bailouts are handled. And you see it out in Fox News. Anyway, Ron Paul built that constituency a long, long time ago. And so that's kind of how we saw that. And I knew that going into that campaign, that those people were out there and that we just needed to provide a platform to them for them to participate and project their issue set onto this campaign. Even though he didn't have it on his issues, they knew that he went to those conferences. And we're talking 15 years of groundwork being laid of all these people who have absolutely no voice whatsoever on the national stage. And so that really kind of goes to that broad-based issue leveraging and coalition building.
Right. But his campaign site, as I remember it, you know, it wasn't that fancy. And to me, you know, probably the most important innovation was the decision to post, you know, almost in real time, the name and amounts of donations as they were coming in. And that was what enabled other people to start tracking, you know, how is Ron Paul doing? You know, somebody created a site called RonPaulGraphs.com, which was like this obsessive tracking of all the data. But it was out of that then some people, you know, had the ability to say, hey, you know, let's aggregate our donations all around one day and call it a money bomb. And if we can raise $1 million or whatever the target was, maybe the media will finally pay attention.
Right.
And that came more from the grassroots than it did really come from the you know, the campaign itself. But the decision to be transparent about the donations was obviously a pretty unusual one.
Well, yeah, you know, for us, what we did first, actually, was he needed $40,000 to open up a new office and to staff it with, you know, people and chairs and all that stuff. So we just did a money bomb for that $40,000 office. We showed pictures of what we needed. And we said this is all we needed, and people loved it. I mean, we raised, I think, you know, a couple hundred thousand off that. And then we stretched that out to be a week long. It was called Fill the Quill for Constitution Day, and it was a quill, you know, money tracker, people's names.
Right. Sounds like the Bat for Dean.
Exactly. No, and that's the Bat for Dean is one of my favorite all-time things in politics. Like, that's I have a screenshot of that somewhere, and I'm going to get it printed in frames somewhere at some point. But that's kind of what we did. And then, of course, the grassroots from that broad-based support, what we wanted to do was allow people to kind of stand with Ron by putting their names up there and so that you could continue to kind of leverage. Like, if you saw somebody you knew or somebody in your hometown, you're going to more closely associate with that campaign and be more compelled to be a donor.
Right, but this was done in a very low-tech way, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, just scrolling them across the front page of the site.
Exactly.
But it turned out to be a brilliant stroke, as it were. So that's how you got into the poll campaign. And were you working at the strategy level, or it was implementing and, you know, I mean, how much did you have?
We actually had a large amount of input. I mean, they were such a small campaign when we got started. We were pretty us along with Justine Lamb, who's the campaign manager. I mean, we were talking to them every day, proposing the next thing and So it was actually a really fun time, and we got to do it all remotely, so that was cool. We didn't have to go to D.C. And we just did it from our offices and had the projector going with those money bomb things projected to the wall while all the programmers sat around working on stuff for Ron and building out a we did a bunch of databasing work trying to get, like, a basic kind of precinct management system going, but we just ended up running out of time for that. So that was kind of the ground level of what later became Freedom Connector, was this idea that you've got this broad base of people that want to connect with one another. You know, the original idea was to do that for Ron's presidential campaign and then maybe for something else, but they ended up not really doing that. So we just kind of put that elsewhere. So that's
and that's interesting that in the same way, I didn't know that, and that's very interesting because, you know, the truth is that, you know, the Dean campaign near its end, there were people working on something called Dean Space, you know, as if it were MySpace. And it was the same notion of enabling Dean supporters to connect to each other locally. And that code went with the guys who went with Blue State Digital or created Blue State Digital. They then continued to work on it and built versions of it first for some groups in different states that were also looking for this sort of member-to-member network effect, like Progress Now in Colorado. They also sold a version to the DNC. And then when MyBo, you know, when the Barack Obama campaign hired Blue State Digital, it was they had this, you know, I mean, they had a rudimentary version of it. They kept working on it. But, you know, sort of it's interesting to see how the idea and the code travel. So this was so Freedom Connector really has its roots in the poll campaign.
And so I think, you know, frankly, the Tea Party movement does as well. I mean, you like Matt Kibbe wrote about that beautifully in his book, where the TARP fight was kind of the transition from Ron Paul's campaign to a broader Tea Party movement in a lot of ways. TARP.
Well,
TARP
there are people. I've talked to people in the Tea Party who would. Some of whom, obviously there's overlap, and others sound like this was a completely new, you know, step into political engagement. In other words,
I mean,
they hadn't been previous.
It's a lot bigger than I'm not saying all Tea Partiers are Ron Paulers by any means, but it's that engagement, going to rallies, doing signs. That was a big part of the fun of the Paul campaign was what we saw the Tea Party movement doing in 2009. So anyway, at least from where I stand, that was that the TARP fight was where that type of political activism, both online and off, went from where it was just kind of a Ron Paul thing to now it's like, oh wow.
Right. Let's talk about Freedom Connector. And this was launched a year ago at CPAC, right? That was the sort of invitation.
That was the launch.
Yeah.
That was the start of our beta. And so we've been in beta for about a year exactly. And
people can find this at connect.freedomworks.org if you're interested.
Yeah, or freedomconnector.com also works.
Oh, okay.
So we've just been over the last year, you know, continuing to invite the Freedom Works membership to participate. You know, we're not a billion-dollar organization. We don't have a ton of money to go through, you know, inside beta testing and alpha testing and all that kind of stuff. So what we do is we, you know, listen to the community and develop features and then launch them and then ask people to give us feedback. And we get a bunch of great feedback from these activists. And they're really helping us right now build a final tool. Like, it's by no means complete. There's a ton of things we want to add to it. But that's why it's for us, it's really valuable to just have it out there and say, hey, this is a living, breathing system that we're changing, and we're changing it to make it more useful to you. What do you want to add? And, we've got, you know, right now people are really asking us to add a system whereby they can submit links in a centralized location, and those links can be distributed more broadly, to the network. And so we're kind of having a lot of fun developing a news and link aggregating system and integrating that directly with the profiles. So, you know, if you've got you know, a campaign announcement that you have in Utah, submit it to the campaign section, and if it gets enough votes or has enough comments or things like that, it'll then get distributed to
right.
the people you want it to be distributed to on the site. So it's
right.
kind of
so
a,
it's got
a fun little Reddit dig integrated to your connector platform kind of thing. So I'm having so much fun with that because that's, again, kind of goes to this, like, FreedomWorks is really a cool organization to work with because they're so committed to that decentralized model. You know, they don't want to become the next Republican Party. They just want to facilitate whatever the grassroots wants to do.
I have a lot of questions about it. I mean, just to give people a little more background. So, you know, launched a year ago. It's now got, I'm looking at the site, it's got 167,000 users, nearly 7,000 groups formed on the site, more than 2,000 events listed, 600,000 comments. How many, you know, how much activity is going on, you know, a daily or weekly basis there? I mean, I you know, probably not every single person is active on a daily basis.
No, for us, it's originally we deployed it as an events tool. I mean, you know, and it's kind of morphed into a discussion, link sharing community. It's hard to slap exactly how much activity there is. I would say we probably get between 20 to 30% of the membership is active on a weekly basis. It would be I think what the numbers that they were looking at. You know, it's right now we're in that. I kind of look at what LinkedIn was. You know, you would check in with it. I would literally go to a LinkedIn profile once a month. And now I'm going to LinkedIn more because I've continued to add features that make me want to go to it on a more regular basis. And, you know, for us, it wasn't designed as an everyday platform. It was designed as a create your event and get people to RSVP and then, you know, connect to people and then go offline with it, really, is what the original design was. And now as the movement is and I use that to kind of describe the freedom movement in at large, but as that's changing and becoming more of the establishment, the needs for a connector to kind of become a more regular, daily active thing where you can share things about the campaigns that you're running or the site that you're starting or things like that. That's where we're going with it now. So that's kind of the genesis of it. It wasn't really originally designed as an everyday thing, so.
Sure. Was there any worry? You know, I'm just imagining the type of response that lots of groups would have to the notion that you would put up a site that anybody can join, you know, and use for practically any purpose, right? I mean, wouldn't FreedomWorks or, you know, whoever be nervous that, you know, the site could be taken over by, you know, whatever faction? I mean, isn't there a fear of losing control of where it goes?
You know, I think that that really kind of shows their dedication to the free market of ideas. There is always that gut check that you do whenever you're deploying something like this. But if you're upfront, that's what it is. And that's what we've been that from the start. This is an open platform other than, you know, bigotry or, you know, adult.
Yeah, I'm like, do you guys have to keep an eye on it or it just does?
Oh, yeah, we have built in, I mean, every content node, every piece of user submitted content has the ability for someone to flag it for content like that. So it goes, that gets centralized with the staff and they handle those things. So it's been a very, very clean experience. I mean, you certainly get people that are, hawking their food storage business, you know, to 500, you know, different groups, and then you send those people a polite message saying, "Hey, this is not the appropriate use for the site," just for you to go around selling stuff. But you know, you generally communicate with people, and they say, "Oh, I'm sorry," and you know, they're very, very, very cordial. And I think you can look to the Tea Party movement, like the rallies that they've had. You know, you don't have arrests, you don't have a lot of that offensive or disruptive behavior. And that's really kind of translated to the Freedom Connector audience. I mean, sure, there's heated arguments. Yes, there are bad actors, especially online where you can create an anonymous account. We do try to encourage people to use their real names and their link up their Facebook accounts, and that helps limit that sort of behavior. But it's all in all been a really very, very clean and respectful audience that's really focused on issues. And sure, there are issues that are being discussed that FreedomWorks doesn't have a position on. You know, FreedomWorks isn't really a foreign policy oriented organization. And some of our users are very, very passionate about that, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we want. In fact, we're designing a system, and what we want the system to be is to have the ability for anyone to deploy an issue that aggregates all the content throughout the site when people use the tags for that issue. And what we're going to do is implement a voting system where you can create your Agenda 21 issue and ask all your friends to vote for it. And if it reaches a certain number of votes, it becomes a national connector issue and maybe even becomes a category for news to be distributed, kind of like a subreddit, if you will, on Reddit. And you know, that's not something that FreedomWorks is dedicated toward to their activists, to let them have a voice. And that's truly trying to harness and give, not really harness, but give that decentralized movement a voice to continue to hold elected officials accountable to those issues.
Yeah. Are there restrictions on how it's used because it's sponsored by FreedomWorks because of their tax status or I forget whether they're not C3, C4, all that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. There is a FreedomWorks super PAC, FreedomWorks for America. I don't interact or do anything with them. I'm working so much with the C3 and C4, and Freedom Connector is can't host that type of content. Their direct messaging and those sort of things. There's a lot of legal
right. So if somebody puts something on the site saying vote for so and so, I mean, can users advocate for candidates?
You're going to have to – I think that's one of the things that –
I mean, it looks like they do.
That's going to be dealt with in the future. You know, it's like if my response to that when people ask me that is Facebook giving a contribution to Obama when someone posts something for Obama? And, you know, if that's the same thing that we're doing here. We're just creating a platform. It's not us.
Exactly. Not us. You could argue that it's the – what is it? The safe harbor provision?
Yeah.
You're not directly using the site to advocate for a candidate, and it's a platform for anybody else to advocate for all kinds of things.
Right.
I'm guessing that's within the safe harbor.
I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah.
So.
Right. But every now and then you have to consult one.
Exactly.
I want to go back. We're coming up on the halfway point, and, you know, so I want to just alert folks who are listening that, you know, we'll start taking questions shortly. But so you said something really interesting at the beginning about how you thought that this cycle, that what's taking place on the Republican sort of grassroots side of things is an expansion of, you know, the kind of the base organizing itself in ways that are more sort of free of the control of the campaigns, and that part of the reason why there hasn't been, you know, the usual coalescing around one candidate is, you know, that people have these sort of independent nodes, right? And it isn't just the Ron Paul people, who obviously are all rallying around him, but you're saying Tea Party people and now evangelicals also using online networking capabilities to kind of talk amongst themselves and, in effect, maintain an independent identity. And I wish you would actually – you know, talk a bit more about that. I understand, obviously, why, you know, that makes sense in relation to Ron Paul. But, you know, it's less clear to me if it's really true that it's become that much easier for people to kind of maintain an independent identity and not just, you know, fall into the need to fall behind a candidate. I mean, there's this real strong desire to find a candidate that you can back that, you know, I've seen the same thing on the left when, you know, during the primary, you know, in 2008, very strong factions formed backing candidates, not so much staying apart from the candidates and kind of keeping themselves.
Sure.
I don't want to use the word pure because it sounds, you know, like standoffish, but, you know, holding to their principles, if you will. So you're saying this is what, you know, you think is driving some of the ongoing.
I, I do. I mean, especially look at the pro-life movement. I mean, there's so much anger towards Romney from those guys, and it's just really interesting to see how they.
But you see the online piece of this mattering more, because in the old days, I'm going to press you on this a bit because it's a really interesting point, and I think you're probably right. But you know, in the old days, what we had were a bunch of kingmakers, lots of national networks like the Christian Coalition and Focus on the Family and so on, and they did kind of coalesce behind candidates, and their followers followed. And now, to some degree, maybe those groups are what you're suggesting is that group, those groups aren't as strong, and their followers are now, in effect.
They're listening
themselves.
To their neighbors. They're listening to their family members who's sending them an email or tweeting or posting a Facebook message, reinforcing the principle. And the conservative movement has a lot of different principled factions, but most people in that movement. They latch onto a couple of those, and they're very, very, very steady with respect to their dedication to that issue. And that does go above candidates. And that's at least in my experience.
But more now than before?
I think more so because they're seeing their friends, their family, and people that they share those principles with raise an issue. Hey, Santorum voted for this, or Newt Gingrich, didn't back, or is anti-gun, and that's sets off alarm bells,
right.
And they're like, well, I'm not sure about Newt Gingrich.
I'm a show me guy. So is there? I mean, other than obviously people talking amongst themselves, is this what you're seeing, for example, in the sort of the gist of the dominant conversations on FreedomWorks, or are you seeing this in other places online?
I'm seeing a lot on Facebook and also on Connector, for example. Here's a show me. Herman Cain.
Right.
We saw the Herman Cain bubble, if you will, before Herman Cain became huge. And people were on the site, loving Herman Cain, loving Herman Cain, loving Herman Cain. And when the allegations came up, the conversation was all about, and maybe I'm going the wrong direction with this, so correct me, but they were the grassroots work were really dedicated towards, well, let's have proof of, this could just be Romney, stirring up people. And of course it spiraled out of control, but what you saw was all of those people shifting to Newt, right while that was happening. And it was kind of funny because Newt's not really the,
But the way it's seen on the site is very much – it's extremely granular. It's not like you have – well, actually, I should change that. I mean, you do run a regular poll, right? I mean, there's sort of some sort of leading edge content.
And there's the ability for people to rate each piece of – each comment rather than just respond to it. So you see these comments, and if they have 20 or 30 – up ratings when someone's like, hey, Newt's gone, Herman Cain's gone, but we should consider Newt, or, Ron Paul's the guy, you can kind of aggregate those discussions with those upvotes and with the responses.
That's interesting.
Maybe I got a little off track from what's
happening. No. I mean, I'm not totally disagreeing. I'm just saying, the people who, for example, who have studied the Tea Party movement suggest that, it actually is, that the size of the grassroots base, the active grassroots base, is not really that large. There's a lot of people who are, think of themselves as sympathetic or supporters, and there's plenty of media attention. But in terms of finding the number of Tea Party groups, that have meetings, that have, lists, the number is less than 1,000. That's still a lot of people, by the way, and to a large degree organizing themselves, that you can have a big, big impact. But I'm struck by the suggestion that what you're saying is that the leadership sort of piece of this, just because the head of a big evangelical group might say, let's rally around.
Romney's our guy.
Yeah, that has very little effect.
Oh, look at Chris Christie. Here's a perfect example. Chris Christie, everybody loved Chris Christie. Mm-hmm. And when he endorsed Romney, people were pissed. The grassroots was furious. Wow. I can't believe he sold us out about this, sold us out to Romney. Oh, look, he's just an establishment guy. I thought he was the guy. You know, I believe that Chris Christie suffered with the grassroots,
right.
A little bit of a political setback.
And same thing
with Pelini. Same thing with Tim Pelini. You know, he dropped out, and everybody was like, oh, you know, he was a good guy. You know, they weren't attached to him, but then they kind of saw him for what, you know, he's an establishment guy, even though he was trying to be
right.
the anti-Romney, he just went to Romney. And you're seeing, you know, and that's, I'm seeing that happen even down to the congressional level. You know, someone, like, let's look at, I love Jeff Flake, and Jeff Flake's awesome. But, you know, some of the grassroots guys are kind of like, well, you know, Jeff Flake, you know, supports Romney, right? So, you know, it's just things like that. Where I would point you in the direction of to look for the show me element.
Yeah, I mean, the other argument, I think this is it's absolutely valid. I mean, the other argument that people make about why the race is lasting as long as it is, you know, other than the sort of this dynamic of anybody but Romney, is number one, the debates, the huge number of debates, they take a lot of time, and they skew the focus of the race to who's got good debating skills, as opposed
sure.
to maybe grassroots capabilities. The second is the big, you know, the super PAC money, which has enabled, you know, candidates who normally would have dropped out after New Hampshire
yeah, right.
for lack of money,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of factors. I just would contend that this is something that maybe the establishment folks don't want to talk about. And it's not necessarily something that you can directly point to that has a statistic like how much money Sheldon Adelson has given Newt Gingrich. But
right.
We all know that the conservative movement is moving online at a little slower pace than the left. And I would contend that those discussions that used to just happen around the dinner table or at the lodge or at the you know at church are now happening on an ongoing and constant basis. And that is strengthening the issue principal groups to continue to be steadfast and then highlight the candidate's weaknesses
right.
in a lot of different respects. For example, Ron Paul, you know, he suffers a lot with the people who are really concerned with, you know, Sharia law and, you know, foreign policy. And whereas otherwise, you know, it's not something he goes around talks about, but
mm-hmm.
they're you know, they really don't like him and they're very apt outspoken about
mm-hmm.
why Ron Paul's dangerous in
mm-hmm.
their minds.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I, that's not something that, that a leader of an organization would necessarily be able to do as strongly as what is happening right now.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'm going to take a break here for a second just to say we're talking with Martin Avila from Terry Eclipse. If you have a question and would like to get into the conversation, the simplest way to do it is to hit *6 on your phone, and then I'll be able to unmute you and get you into the queue. You can also tweet using PD+, and we'll just take a pause for a second to see if anybody does want to jump in. But if not, I've got plenty more questions for you, Mark.
Okay. And while we're waiting for a second, I'll just say all these opinions and things I'm saying are my own, and I don't represent FreedomWorks at all. So.
Okay. Yeah. That's good. That's a good. disclaimer, we should have said that at the beginning. So I'm thinking going first. All right, let's get off the presidential race for a second. Where else do you see the sort of grasp of, you know, enabling, if you will, pushing power to the edges and enabling people, you know, to do more with each other? First of all, where else do you see that happening on the conservative landscape? And where should we be watching in terms of its potential impact?
I'm really excited about holding the media accountable.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of anger, and you saw it with Newt, right? The
right.
bubble, the last you did. I am really interested to see and build a tool that will allow the grassroots to hold commentary and hold the media on all levels. Accountable to a different issue set,
mm-hmm.
and I think there's going to be a lot of energy behind this. And I'm it's an experimental thing, but if we can provide a platform for that to happen on a broader base and not just do it for candidates. I think that's going to be something that's going to be really interesting. Also, we, you know, from a technical standpoint, we're looking at mobile, you know, keeping the dialogue going while you're, you know, doing your errands or at work or whatever. So we're going to be going mobile from a technical standpoint with Connector. But anyway, from where we should look, I think, is on the conservative side, there's a lot of, and, you know, you see it on the left too, but there's a lot of frustration with the traditional media outlets and how they report on everything and what issues they're covering. And it's really only happening from the bloggers, and, you know, those bloggers are struggling to find a way to get out their message when they have the right message that the grassroots is eager for. So, you know, sites like Politico just don't really cut it for a lot of conservatives.
Do you worry, though? I mean, a lot of people, you know, there's no question that you know, the net enables more voices, and so we have a much wider range of points of view now available, you know, and viable, you know, that people are, you know, making a living doing this. But do you worry that there's a chance that this ends up with more polarization, that it creates a situation where people listen to only the points of view they already agree with? And I mean, that's, you know, I'm thinking of the larger effect. What do you think where's the balance point? Where should it be?
I don't really worry about that all that much. Sometimes I'll you know, talk to someone or see a discussion where I'm like, oh, you know, those people aren't really opening their minds up to, you know, alternative viewpoint. I just don't know if that's it doesn't seem to be the majority of everyday folks to me. Like, you know, most people the extreme is always going to be there. But I think they're an extreme minority. And most people are thinking pretty critically and logically. And I think the more information that you can get out to people, the more the better off we're all going to be.
What about, there are a couple other issues that I'm sort of curious your view on these. So we just saw a really interesting, uprising on the internet, if you will, over these online piracy bills. Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Where were you on that? And you know, I was struck that, you know, this seemed to be an issue that, kind of cut across the political spectrum. You know, Huffington Post went dark, but so did Drudge Report. You know, Red State came out against it. As did Daily Kos. Patrick Ruffini, noted Republican Online operative, friend of ours, was leading Don't Censor the Net at the same time that, you know, groups on the left were also involved. So what's your view of that? And also, you know, where do you think as someone who's, you know, kind of watching the pulse of conservatives online, was it as strong there as it was elsewhere?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the, I think the core part of what it means to be an American is liberty versus tyranny. And that was pure, just tyranny. Big business corruption that was using, influence and lobbyists to try to get something across that that enough of us care enough about to take issue with. I mean, so I think that's when you have that situation when there's when that choice is really clear. I think that's when you get a good when you can see really clearly. When bipartisanship can be bad inside the Beltway and really good on the outside, you have all, you know, you cut across the, you know, you saw the insiders on the Republican side and you saw the insiders on the Democratic side pushing for tyranny. And then you saw the rest of us, working to be free. And so I think that's what it comes down to. And that's an easy choice. So.
Yeah. What about the issue of online privacy? I don't want to ambush you here, but I'm curious, what approach do you take on, you know, like user privacy and user, you know, in terms of data collection? And, you know, I mean, I have a hunch that as people start to figure out just how much campaigns are not just collecting data on them, but targeting and, you know, to some degree manipulating, that there could be a big backlash.
I'm not one. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. I'm sorry. I just had to sneeze.
I am generally very against brokering of information. I really don't like the fact that I have to be on Facebook to do what I do. And I think that's the general sentiment that most people that I work with share. I mean, there's certainly email lists, you know, that have to go out for communication purposes. But in terms of tracking people's likes and dislikes and political leanings and all those sorts of things, I'm really hesitant and don't like any time that that's kind of talked about. I know there's a lot of monetization there, but that's not really where I put my focus professionally.
But you know campaigns are doing it, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, absolutely. I'm not asking you to name names here, but you know both sides do this.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that in some degree it's considered the state of the art now to be able to do it well.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, you know, it's a scary, it's for me, you know, as I've, you know, fiscal conservative libertarian that I am, I just, that seems like it just makes me uncomfortable, and I know that's the way it needs to go, and I prefer that to create a platform that allows people to dive in when they want to dive in rather than reaching them when they don't want to be reached. And I would rather create that open platform for people to engage when they want to engage. That's where my philosophy, where I try to deploy technologies as much as possible rather than hitting people when they're having dinner. You know, I think, you know, as communication continues to become more and more a part of our life, I would hope there's going to be a point where people just get sick and tired of that kind of stuff, just like they're sick and tired of robocalls.
Yeah.
And just like they're sick and tired of direct mail and just sick and tired of getting texts, unsolicited texts. You know, those are all really bad things that we all hate. And so, you know, yes, it's state of the art to be able to reach people and quantify what's, you know, based off Facebook activity, you know, what the political leanings are and those sorts of things. But again, that's centralizing data for, you know, the old good old boys command and control structure that I'm just not really all that interested in, to be honest. Like, it's just like that's, I don't know. It's frustrating to some extent.
Well, you and I agree about this. I'm just curious how much you think people are more broadly aware of what,
of how much,
you know,
being tracked.
Yeah, and you know, to what degree that should, you know, we should maybe try and make them more aware. You know, I mean, frankly, you know, one of the unique things about personal democracy and what we do is it is a place where, you know, folks of different political persuasions can sort of set aside the partisan disagreements and talk about the things we actually do agree about. We're all fascinated by how tech is enabling a power shift, right? And, you know, I think fundamentally we think that's a good thing. And then, you know, and there's a lot of trust that, you know, as more people get to participate in the process, the results should get better.
Right.
But this, you know, this is one of these cases where, you know, big data, the ability to do things with big data is not in the hands of little people. You know, it's very.
It can only be in the hands of big people. I mean,
well, it seems that, you know, it's very expensive to be able to do these kinds of things. And secondly, you know, folks aren't necessarily aware, or worse, are seduced, you know, because it's free, right? Hey.
That's the beauty of Facebook, right? I mean, that's.
Do you ever find, and here's another question just related to, you know, conservative groups. Is there any pushback about, you know, on going online because the online space is seen as, oh gosh, a little dangerous, if you will? I mean, I recently, you know, did some ran across this in all places, Orthodox Jewish community, where there's a pushback against Facebook.
Yep. Oh, it's very prevalent, very prevalent. A distrust of Facebook. You know, things like Apple tracking your location on your iPhone, those sort of things. people are they're not happy about that. There's from the libertarian side to the evangelical Mark of the Beast people, you know, there is that distrust and that worry, and then not that knowing, and not some people are ignorant of it, but you know, some people who are even the least technical are more worried than people who are more technical will need to use it. People think would be ignorant of what's going on are actually very careful of
how
much they're putting on.
Does Connector tell people about what data you may be collecting or how people can sort of protect their privacy?
We're not really collecting all that much data, to be honest.
Uh-huh.
You've asked me before about those kind of data-oriented questions, and then that's maybe why I've come up short for you on those, because we're really not focused on that. And we certainly want to know just overall site health and use and those sorts of things. And we're constantly kind of working on that. But in terms of behaviors and natural language processing and those sorts of things, we want to deploy those tools to make the site more useful, not necessarily for our political gain, because our political gain is based off of issues that we know people stand behind. And it's easy to when you stand behind on principle and you stand on issues that you know people believe in, you don't have to go through all that big data stuff to convince them that you're doing the right thing. You just tell them what you're doing, and then you see where if they stand with you or not, and move forward. I mean, it's the guys that, and this is, you call me a critic. This is probably where I'm a critic. Lamar Smith needs big data. I don't need big data.
Right.
Tom McClintock doesn't need big data. He needs the email list to communicate people, to tell them what he's doing. But it's the bad guys that need the big data.
Because they're trying to be all things to all people.
Exactly.
And
they need to know what Bill believes in, so I can tell Bill where I share with him and where I don't share things with that he believes in. I need to make sure he doesn't hear about it.
Rather than just say,
here's what I believe in. Here's everything I believe in. Here's everything I've done.
Right.
Judge me. Stand with me. Let's go and do this.
Right.
Those are the people I like to work with. That's the only people I can work with, because I'm not one who's going to put lipstick on a pig.
Well, it's really interesting, because what I'm hearing, just to sort of sum up our conversation, though, I should just pause. Last chance, folks, if you want to ask a question, hit *6 and I'll pull you in. But what I'm hearing is that by work, when you enable people to participate first, right, you build the platform around enabling lots of member participation, as opposed to building a platform that enables, just sort of a centralized campaign authority, whatever, to collect a lot of data and then sort of push out messages at people, right? That the type of campaign or cause that will work better in this sort of networked environment is one that has to be genuinely resonating with people. And for you, that's the sort of principled, honest, take me or leave me, but this is who I am kind of message. And
That's exactly right. And, it's an experiment. And, so is America. It's like we're just constantly experimenting with that open transparency and honesty, to be honest. That's what we're doing. And, it may or may not work. I mean, we may lose out to the big data guys because they can sell themselves to anybody in any way. But, I think the minority has won before, I think we will win in the past or win in the future.
Well, there is a saying, organized minorities beat disorganized majorities.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And organized and passionate minorities. And that's what we are. And that's, those 1,000 groups across, God bless those 1,000 groups, Tea Party groups across America, because that's exactly who they are. And that's okay if they're a little scared of Facebook, because we could still win this.
Right. Great. Well, great. This has been great, Martin. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, we've been listening to Martin Avila of Terry Clips talking about how open networks can work to build grassroots power on the right. Check out the freedomconnect.com,
freedomconnector.com.
freedomconnector.com if you want to see all of this in action, and you can join and play around with the tools. Once again, we've spent another hour here talking on Personal Democracy Plus with movers, shakers, innovators, thinkers, and doers in the place where technology collides with politics.